Hello and welcome to episode number 38 of the At U2 podcast, talking all things U2, including new album news, tour dates, community discussions from the staff of At U2, and maybe even new song news and new U2 40 news. For this episode, we are going to be doing the album that we debated not doing originally, but due to popular demand and anger, we are doing Under a Blood Red Sky. But for this episode, I've got Kenny back with us. Kenny, hello.
Hi there, how are you doing?
I'm well. Where are you coming to us from in the world
this time? I'm coming from, I was going to say sunny Scotland, but it's actually dark outside, so it is. We did have summer yesterday, so yeah.
Summer's over?
Summer came and went yesterday, so right. It is. So.
And Sherry's back from, I mentioned Kenny was on the October podcast, the October album. Sherry's back from her boy exile, as it were.
Hey, I'm the kind of trouble that you enjoy.
All right. And so we are, like I said, we're going to be discussing Under a Blood Red Sky in this ongoing series of album by album time filler until we wait for a new album news.
Which is basically what Under a Blood Red Sky was.
Right. There we go. It's appropriate. So first, a bit of miscellaneous updates and news and stuff, just in case you're not obsessively refreshing at u2.com like you should be. First off, thanks to @4OUX on Twitter. Yesterday I was driving for about 8 hours and they tweeted at me and said, just try to pronounce my nickname out loud for 8 hours. That'll help you stay awake, which it did. So thank you. And thanks for that caring tweet. And then also, like we said, a little song dropped over the weekend. Of course, it never fails when you're away from computers and in a slow internet area. All of a sudden, new album or new music happens, and by the time you get around to it, it's gone and been removed by lawyers already. But you guys, I'm sure, heard it over the weekend. What did you think of the collaboration? Do you say Kygo? Is there some DJ Kygo? I don't know. We're too old to know how to say these things.
He's basically this generation's Moby.
There you go. A Norwegian DJ and producer debuted The Best Thing, a new collaboration with U2 at the Cloud Nine Festival in his hometown of Bergen, Norway.
Well, I led the entire first part of my OTR column about it. And by the time it published a few hours later, all the online videos started being taken down from the RIAA going after people to request that they get taken down. So perhaps DJ Kygo did not have permission.
Yeah, there's some speculation that maybe he wasn't supposed to premiere it around the world.
What do you expect when you've got tens of thousands of people at a festival? You know it's going to get online somehow. Yeah. That's what is boggling my mind right now. It's either you ride the viral wave of getting stuff out there and letting the fans do all the promotion for you and all of that stuff, or just don't put something out there. You know what people are going to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is turning into a pattern. So if you two really want to have a social media presence and have that viral quality, they have to let it actually happen. So I don't know which entity it was who raised a stink about it, but it's going to make for a very interesting fall because people are now going to start to be sheepish about sharing stuff.
Yeah, do you think that? I don't know. We'll see. I guess it seems like the idea that you two can somehow put this back in a box. I'm going with the assumption that it was who is it? Not principal, but the one above Live Nation, that's a touring promotion. Anyways, somebody higher up than actually like Bono obviously is worried about this. I'm guessing, but like the idea that you can put it back in the box after it's been out there like this is kind of
silly. because it wasn't commercially available and it wasn't on the band's own terms, I believe is probably part of the problem.
Yeah.
Either that or they just wanted to do a little test of what could happen or what people liked as a little tester, and okay, they like it, now quickly take it down.
it could also be, I mean, I was thinking as well, I mean, that was the beach house clip, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe they thought, oh, you know, it's already out there. I don't think it's as. I think you're right. I think what we're trying to say. I don't think it's contrived at all. I think it was totally meant. I think it's just a bit of a stunt.
Yeah,
to be honest.
The beach clips. That was outside of Bono's private residence, so I could understand why people would be a little upset about that. However, if anybody knew the back history about the beach clips, which Matt wrote about in his OTR column a couple weeks ago, you know, that is normally a signal to say the new stuff is coming. You know, I feel comfortable enough to be cranking it at Spinal Tap's 11, you know, so the entirety of the south of France can hear it. So what do you expect? However, that is a private residence. In this particular case, it's at a public festival.
Yeah.
With thousands and thousands and thousands of people in attendance. So there's a slight difference. The music was the same. Lyrics were slightly different between the beach clips from a few weeks ago and the actual performance. So I can understand one. The other one, there had to be permissions that were not there. And it will be interesting to see what happens over the fall. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Infamously or whatever, I guess, U2 fan site, U2ITNOLTU on Facebook saw their entire Facebook group was deleted because they posted to it. So it's not just that they're going after YouTube and, you know, trying to pull off videos there. They're going literally everywhere and sort of blazing a big path of destruction almost in terms of the fans also getting hit by this in a big way. And so, which is really too bad. And hopefully that, I don't know if it has been resolved yet, but hopefully it can be resolved soon if not. There's an article on u2songs.com as well, which we'll link to, that has a bit more info on it and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so, they were the ones who first broke it.
Yeah, via the Norwegian story that sort of tipped them off, obviously, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, thousands of people in attendance. You can't sort of hope it's going to just stay where it is. Maybe 10 years ago that worked, but...
Although I do have to say, so back in January, I went to see Garth Brooks in Worcester, and I didn't realize at the time that he does not like it if you put up parts of his performance on YouTube, and my video was within 24 hours cease and desisted and all of that other stuff. Now, meanwhile, I've got 15-second clips all over Instagram, but if it's a whole song, they really didn't take too kindly to that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it varies artist to artist, U2 hasn't been as an artist that upset about stuff like that. We know that when material leaked of Madonna's before she wanted it out, Maverick went after people very quickly with the cease and desist. So I have to wonder if in this particular case that's happening because the single is not officially out yet. And we don't even know if that is truly the single,
right.
But I would think that it would be.
Yeah, that's the assumption, or that a lot of people are jumping to, is that this is going to be the single, which, I mean, does make sense that it would be if it's the first new music in a while that we're hearing from U2, that they wouldn't just pop it on it like a collaboration, and that would be sort of the way that it goes. But anyways, Kenny, did you hear the song? What are your thoughts on this song?
Did I hear it? This is going to sound a bit weird. I kind of listened to it, but I didn't listen to it, partly because it's a remix. I'm not a big lover of that side of U2, so all that kind of perfecto stuff they did during Zoo TV, etc.
Right.
It was all right. It didn't really particularly ring my bell. However, you know, that said, of course I did listen to it. I thought Bono's vocals were sounding really good. And there's some really kind of great melodies in there. The problem is you couldn't tell, well, in my head, I couldn't tell completely it was a U2 song because of all the remix stuff that goes all around with it. So I'll reserve judgment, I think. But from what I heard, I mean, certainly, as I say, he was sounding great on it, actually, I thought. So
yeah, that's what I thought too, is vocal-wise, it sounded really good. But yeah, unfortunately, we, due to obvious reasons, we will not be playing any samples or otherwise linking to it or even mentioning it. I don't even know what we just talked about. So if you're from...
It's just like Fight Club.
Yeah. We didn't talk about anything. So there you go. We're staying far away from that one. Kenny, you have a bit of an update for the U240 event happening in Dublin, or yeah.
Yeah, it was just, obviously it's been sold out for a wee while. It's on September the 24th, but it was just to kind of direct people to the fact that the Joshua Tree band that's going to be playing there are actually asking U2 fans, I suppose those that are attending, but even those that are not, to help choose the set list. So they've listed 15 songs that U2 don't really play that often these days, and giving everyone a chance to have a go at voting for them to see what they're going to play. And as an aside as well, as a I guess as a special gesture as well, they're going to play Acrobat, which is a kind of at U2 staff pick, which should be really interesting, I think it should be. But anyway, it's just to direct people there, please vote. Be interested to see what everybody would like to hear. But, you know, 11 o'clock TikTok would be a really good idea, just as a wee bit of a steer for anyone that's listening.
Just a little plug there, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, right now leading is a sort of homecoming is 16% of the votes, but 11 o'clock is at 8%. So, Kenny, you might want to find a few friends and start stuffing the ballots. But yeah, I was going to mention there's no Acrobat on there, but obviously you're saying that, yeah, and it's written there, they're going to play Acrobat as a special staff pick. So finally people can stop asking when the Joshua Tree is going to play Acrobat.
Exactly.
At least not, they can still keep asking about U2 to play it. But so if you're not able to make it to Dublin because the tickets are sold out, my little Canadian accent slipped in there, or maybe it's too expensive to fly over to Dublin, you're wanting to maybe also connect with other folks with U240 events. We've got one happening as well in Cleveland, September 24th and 25th. I'm going to be there. Not that that's the whole reason to come. Sherry's going to be there. Sherry, do you have some more details you want to spill?
But that should totally be the reason to come.
Yeah.
We have partnered with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They've been more than generous with working with us for this fantastic weekend. They're actually putting the fan in fantastic. Wristbands are going to be $40 for the whole weekend. So that's at a discount. We are going to have some U2 related activities going on. There's going to be a movie fest that's going to be happening within the theater there. So imagine, you know, the world's best audio in your living room, and that's what it's going to be like. So that'll be great. I believe we're going to be doing some live podcasting while we're there as well. We're going to have some contests and prizes. Beth Nabby and Chris LeClaire are bringing up the U2 tattoo project materials, and they're going to have a display there. And there's a lot more that's still in the works. And this is so unlike us to have so many details coming together at the last minute. But we have so many moving pieces right now, and we just want to have everything confirmed before we finalize everything. But I am happy to say that we will have on that Saturday night, the 24th, a 9:30 p.m. showing of Rattle and Hum in an actual movie theater. And for me, that's probably the most exciting part of the whole weekend, because I've never seen Rattle and Hum in the movie theater. So that's been on my U2 bucket list, and I'll be able to finally cross that one off. But all of the ticketing information, all of that, we are finalizing. And as soon as we have it, we will have it up on the main website and through all of our social media outlets. We will plug that as loud and as fast as we can.
Yeah, understandably, people are curious and probably getting a little impatient trying to figure things out and make plans and stuff, and we appreciate that for sure. And know that we want to tell you as soon as we can confirm it, and not wanting to promise something that, you know, doesn't happen or whatever, and have you be disappointed that you're paid for a flight or whatever, and to arrive and not have
it. But it's going to be, it's still going to be a full day on that Saturday at the Rock Hall. then go off, get dinner in the city, then join up with us at 9:30 for the film. And then once again, all day Sunday with some different things. We're going to try to have different movies for the movie fest at the Rock Hall on Saturday and Sunday. So there won't be a lot of overlap with that to give a fresh weekend. But it's going to be an exciting, fun, as I said, fantastic weekend. And I can't wait to celebrate 40 years of the Larry Mullen Band. Because it's not you two people. You two formed in 78.
Well, we can have that. That maybe there'll be one debate, one fight that's settled in the parking lot there anyways. Rock Hall of Fame.
Fisticuffs.
Yeah. One way to get some publicity for the event is to have a fight in the parking lot. No. And yes, we'll be hoping to do it. We're hoping to do it, technology permitting, definitely a live podcast there and hopefully even live streaming it. I mean, obviously with Periscope, et cetera. We won't be issuing cease and desist to folks who decide to live stream our podcast discussion that may happen from the Rock Hall of Fame and stuff. And yeah, just looking forward to putting some faces to all the names and tweets, Twitters and listeners in the podcast and the chat room and stuff and everybody else that comes out. I've never met any of these people before in reality, so in real life. So I'm hoping that they're all actual people. And we will, unfortunately, I won't be able to get it over to Dublin, but I can't wait to hear and see the party that they're going to have as well. So lots happening.
Yeah, it should be good. Looking forward to it.
And speaking of Kelly Eddington, her U240 coloring book sheet just was released and is available. It's for free off of atu2.com, right?
Yes.
I understand it's free. That's awesome. So if nothing else, it's worth, even if you're not a coloring type person, just to check out her artwork is a great start. But yeah, print them off, color them, bring them to U240 and show them to her, all that kind of stuff. It'd be fun to do. And it's a great little adult coloring book or kid coloring book or any person in between coloring book that you can print off as a U2 fan.
Although there are some adult themed pages in there. So your mileage may vary on how much you want your kids to color them.
Right. There you go. I was going to say, Actung Baby cover album. I don't imagine she went to that.
And the discotheque picture where Larry's giving a middle finger. So right.
There you go. All right, let's move on to the show. But I just want to quickly mention Mary. To the inbox portion of our show. Mary had emailed you, Sherry, and just in a previous episode, I'd mentioned Spotify playlists and things that with U2 sort of collections and things like that, and. And she had mentioned she's got a bunch of them putting in either Spotify form. So Edge's playlist was put on Apple Music, and she or somebody's made a Spotify version. So if you're on Spotify and you want to listen to them, and there's a whole bunch of U2 and Innocence and Experience pre-show playlists, the pre-show European leg, the pre-show playlist albums, Adam's playlist that he put out on Zoo Radio and XFM, and Edge and Larry's Zoo Radio playlist from back in the day, and Bono and Edge's favorite songs, the 2011 playlist, etc. All sort of collecting different stuff from U2 on Spotify. So those will all be linked in the show notes as well. So you can check those out if you're looking for some other U2 related material to listen to while you're waiting for either Best Thing or new U2 music to hit your streaming playlist service of choice.
Thanks, Mary.
Yeah. And if you've got some other playlist connected to U2 that you want us to highlight, just send it a tweet, @U2, #AskAtU2, and tweet that at us. And we will collect that in a future episode, mention it and throw it in the show notes. Anything like that, fan stuff that you've put together, if it's on the web somewhere and you want us to mention it or something like that, we'll do our best anyways. Obviously, if there's a huge flood of stuff, we'll slowly mention it. But just a couple of tweets that came in from @TJU2. I've really been enjoying the latest at U2 podcasts. Thank you very much. And @Charif, I said, I'm so enjoying your album by album U2 podcast. Great idea. So thank you folks for listening. And in lieu of that, let's not spend another 2 hours on other stuff or make this podcast a 2 hour podcast and get to the actual album. So if you're new to this premise, we're talking album by album from Boy to Songs of Innocence, at least at this point, and started all back on episode number 34, which you can find it if you visit goodstuff.fm/ATU2/34 with the Boy album discussion. And for this episode, we're talking about Under a Blood Red Sky, which is, of course, their live recording. And as some may know and others may not, I remember learning this, but I don't remember sort of thinking it as I listened to it. I still think of it as the album recorded live at Red Rocks, because that's what it says on the cover. But apparently I've been lied to all these years, and some of the recordings are not actually from Red Rocks. We're talking the album version, not the movie, of course, the video. But I don't know, Sherry, do you want to spill the beans for somebody, a spoiler, I guess, warning that if they're if this crushes them the way it crushed me.
Well, you know, the album itself came out November 21st and 22nd back in 1983, and it was supposed to be the official way to celebrate the Boy October War era. The band was looking to move on to do other things. So, you know, this was designed to put a period at the end of that particular sentence, so to speak. So what ended up happening was at Red Rocks, it rained and not a lot of people came out. And Steve Lillywhite had done some of the production on it. But when the other producers took a listen, they didn't like what they heard. So what they ended up doing was putting together a mishmash of tracks, where most of the tracks were taken from a show in St. Gorshausen, Germany on August 20th. Another track came from Boston on May 6th. And only Party Girl and Gloria were from the original Red Rocks performance. So this is a mini album, a mini EP or whatever, just to give you a little taster of what U2 Live is all about, seeing as this is only the second official U2 recording of any of their live material. Of the first one was the extended single U2 ROK, but that came out of the Paradise in Boston a few years earlier. And it was really also designed for the people who had heard about this band, you know, and how good they are live. And if you haven't heard anything from them, it was a very inexpensive way to have an entry point into what U2 is all about. So for those who joined in far later, there was a disappointment, because you always equate Under Blood Red Sky as being from Colorado because of the concert video, and that the accompanying album was from that. But yeah, that's not the case. There's a lot of really great in-depth information about the album over at U2 Songs. They've given an exhaustive explanation of all the behind the scenes and issues that came up with the recording and with the release of the album. So I would direct people there and not to your typical Wikipedia. U2 Songs is where you should go to find out all that you've ever wanted to know and more about Under a Blood Red Sky.
Yeah, I'm glad you had to pronounce the name in Germany, first of all. Just got that one out of the way. But
me too.
Exactly. I know for me, I was saying before we start recording, the album as a whole, you had mentioned in Slack asking, like, sort of assuming, are we talking about the album and not the concert video? And in my mind, just, you know, like, I know they have the concert video, obviously, but in my mind, it's just always, I just always associate it with the record or CD or collection of MP3s, whatever it is. And don't even think of the concert video as like a thing. It just hasn't been on my radar enough as a thing to reference or whatever, I guess. But Kenny, were you a big fan of the album when it was released?
Absolutely. For a whole variety of reasons. I love the album cover, that kind of sort of silhouette. And I believe that was taken at Red Rocks, that that image of Bono holding on to the white flag, and it's kind of like that one plus actually Rattle and Hum, the kind of sort of silhouetted image is something I just think they do really, really well. So that was a bit of an attraction, if I'm honest. But musically, yeah, it just kind of it confirmed my my thirst for U2 live. I think I've said it before on this podcast elsewhere that I think that's live is where they're best, and I know that's probably a bit of a cliche actually maybe in U2 world, but it was just a fantastic insight into the band, and a wee bit like I have to say I do kind of associate it with the video, because I did actually have the VHS video before I had the DVD, and that was, you know, kind of sort of fairly at that time that was kind of a big deal actually. So it was so, you know, when I do listen to the album, I do reflect on the video, but I do like the album for the sake of the album, because I think it's a fantastic way they captured the band live, and the energy and enthusiasm on there from the band is just the stuff that really makes me tick about U2. So yeah, love it, absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's often, I mean, less so these days with, obviously, like we've talked about many times, you know, Periscope, et cetera, live streaming of a band is not really a big deal anymore. And sort of seeing a band live, like in person is still a big deal, but like for the band to be able to get word out there of like, this is what we're like live, et cetera, is much easier these days. Back then, you know, especially, it was just like, you had no idea.
Totally unique.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And a concert, a live concert album of some sort is kind of like the, for many people, who, especially a band like U2, who wouldn't necessarily play every single little club along the way, many in the entire world, many people, it's their first opportunity to ever hear U2 live. And, like Sherry mentioned, the U2 Rock album that was out, but definitely wouldn't have had the reach that, you know, Under a Blood Red Sky obviously did. And sort of gives the fans, I think, an opportunity to hear themselves reflected in a way, too, that a studio album obviously doesn't do. And fans get to sort of hear that there's other people like them in a sense that are, you know, seeing this band, loving this band. Like you said, Kenny, the love of the music is warranted and justified by the fact that there's other folks screaming like nuts or whatever when they start certain songs and things like that. And yeah, just kind of,
yeah,
helps.
I think also as well, I mean, I know we'll kind of pick up as we go through the individual songs and stuff like that, but I actually think a lot of the root of some of these songs still comes out when they play live today. You know, if I think about some of the Wails, or the Bono Wail at the beginning of New Year's Day, and you know, this song is not a rebel song and all that sort of stuff. So it kind of consolidated some, I guess U2 history, I suppose, if you want as well. So I think it's kind of special in that sense, but mm-hmm. I just think it's great hearing them live. I love them live, and I know it's produced and mixed and all that kind of sort of stuff, but it sounds great to me.
Yeah.
And it was really important to get that audience sound to come through. That was one of the key things about the album, and also was part of the reason why it went through a few different incarnations, was just because they wanted to have that audience mix come through.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, so you can actually hear, because it is a tough balance of like too much screaming and high pitched EQ'd high kind of sounds that grates on people if you're listening to a live album too much, but, or if it's in there too much, but if it's not enough, then it sounds like you're just playing in an empty room or whatever. And it doesn't have that desired effect of saying like, hey, we actually, you know, warrant the crowds and the screaming and the et cetera. So, all right, well, let's jump right into, the album, the song by song discussion, and we'll play a little sample of each before we get into it. But first up is Gloria.
Bye.
right, Kenny, you want to take the lead on Gloria and your thoughts?
Yeah, some of you might know I quite like the album October. So obviously it's a personal favourite of mine, but the reason I love this song on this album because of exactly that segment you played, Chris, actually, because the energy that comes through in that is that's the stuff that I loved about U2 in the 80s. Now, I'm not saying they're not energetic now. They're obviously slightly older and all that kind of sort of stuff. But it was a bit more, it was less polished. It was a bit more uncoordinated, and you know, Bono wasn't very good at dancing and all that kind of sort of stuff, but the energy that comes through on that track I think is absolutely fantastic, and it's captured in that sort of first sort of 20 seconds 30 second segment. I mean, Larry's drums are fantastic, you know, they absolutely boom, and then you just feel the energy of Bono kicking in, the Edge kicking in, Adam kicking in. And it's just, it's fantastic. And actually, I mean, I loved seeing Gloria again on the Innocent Experience tour, because I actually thought they went back to those kind of energy levels at that age when they played that. They kind of almost got into that kind of groove of being slightly unprofessional. I mean, it's all got very professional now and it's all very slick. And it's part of the reason why I liked U2 then, was they weren't very slick, I guess, if you want from a performance perspective. But absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's just that first 20 seconds, 30 seconds is just mind-blowing, I think. Love it.
Yeah, it's very raw, and I would guess, I remember my guitar teacher complaining a bit about, I think I've mentioned this before too, but complaining about Larry's, like, he's definitely got enthusiasm, but isn't necessarily, at the time anyways, wasn't necessarily always great at keeping the precise tempo the way a nerdy anal guitar teacher would want it to be. But I think that's, like you're saying, it's more about the energy and the enthusiasm for the song in that case, or the concert or whatever at a larger scale that comes across, and why, you know, you don't need necessarily precise metronome level quality on the drums or whatever to get the energy across on a song like that. So how about you, Sari?
Yeah, the I thought that it was a surprise to lead the live album off with that. You know, thinking back when it was first released, you had an A side and a B side. There was no a playing it all the way through. So to not only have a non-war track leading off the album, but to have no war tracks at all, to not have the enthusiasm of a Sunday Bloody Sunday to lead it off, I was kind of taken by what the track was, because for me, I picked up on U2 right around Rattle and Hum, and I started my journey going backwards. So I hadn't heard Boy, October, or War before I heard Under Blood Red Sky. I was going backwards, and I was sort of using Under Blood Red Sky to determine if I should buy Boy, October, or War. So the more that I was finding out about the album, like, oh, this was from the War tour, I expected there to be more war-related tracks on it.
Right, yeah.
So then I'm going, Gloria, what album is that off of? Because back in the day, we, you know, there was no internet. we had to sort of figure it out. So that's what I thought. It's like, hey, that's a different song. I wonder what album that one's off of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because just in terms of going a bit sort of bigger picture, finding the album for me too, coming from newer release and working backwards, there's definitely like the mythology of 40 at that point already was well established, and sort of in U2's history or whatever, as a song that they end every concert with or whatever is what I was told anyways. And so then it was kind of was that sort of working backwards from 40 in a sense for me on at the end of the track or at the end of the album. But yeah, it's an interesting way to sort of look at it as someone coming from the future almost and working backwards, as it were, back to the future. All right, track number two is, unless Kenny, did you, I maybe cut you off. Did you have something else you want to say about Gloria?
No. I think, I mean, that's probably actually fair. I hadn't even thought about it, actually, in that sense, the way Sherry's talking about it. For me, it kind of fits, actually, because I suppose it was a live album about U2, albeit the fact that we're using it to promote something else. But yeah, I can kind of see that, actually. I hadn't really thought about it in that sense. But as I say, that first 20, 30 seconds, that makes up for it all, you know?
Yeah. All right, track number two is 11 o'clock TikTok. Like on other albums or other podcast episodes anyways, all of a sudden I catch myself just listening to the song and not remembering that we're going back into a podcast actually to talk about this and just enjoying the music. But hopefully you at home are, as you're listening, are also that way. And that's kind of what we're, one sort of side project of this is kind of revisiting some older music maybe to some of you and encouraging you to go back and listen and are being reminded of some of the good stuff that is out there that you haven't maybe listened to as much and want to go back and check out. So anyways, 11 o'clock TikTok. Kenny, some thoughts on this one?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One's a real nerdy thing, which we'll come on to in a wee second. But I think for me, you two have got a bit of a history of taking songs that they've recorded, you know, in the studio. And when they actually play them live, it makes the song come alive. Yeah. And, you know, from my perspective, it improves the song vastly compared to what they've managed to capture. Now, the single version of this song I enjoy. I think it's a great track. But particularly the way it's captured on Under a Blood Red Sky, I think really enhances the song from the release. And I guess it just kind of, all it does is compound this thing about U2 and how they transform music live, and why they're really, in my mind, the best live band out there, just in terms of how they convert that stuff. The other thing for me, and this is kind of nerdy, and I actually took a note of this before I came on because I thought there might be some other sad people quite like this as well. But from the 2:44 mark to the 3:22 mark, when Edge starts his solo, it's just it really competes with that first 20-30 seconds of Gloria. It's absolutely, I love it. I think it's one of Edge's best solos captured. And you know, if there's anybody out there, you know, go and take a listen. I even tried to capture the timeline if you want to just go straight there. But it kind of,
I'm just gonna cue it up here, Kenny, and just see if I grabbed it roughly, and I'll fix this in post, I guess, if it's completely wrong, but you can tell me after I play it for a bit here. Yeah, I see what you mean. It's that it's kind of, you can see a taste of where Edge is going to go later on, as a guitar player, in the use of repetition in like looping a sound or whatever, and then increasing the emotion of it each time with an extra note or something each time he plays it or whatever the case may be. And it's a very cool. I was going to say, I think the one thing it was a song I skipped because I couldn't quite figure it out at the beginning, the first bit of the song, and I would miss the last half, even like what you were saying, Kenny. Like, and so I was listening to it again in the car or whatever on the way over here, and just that really loving the last half of it, but never, I remember as a kid or younger anyways, not really getting the first half of it and where it was coming from. It sounded a little bit too 80s-ish or whatever, maybe, I don't know. because I was, you know,
well, it cool, was a song cool. of the 80s.
Yeah.
I was a cool 90s kid who was trying to figure out where Pearl Jam fit next to U2 and like why I would listen to the Guns N' Roses and U2. But and so, but yeah, definitely that sort of last half of it, like you said, is very sort of indicative of where they're headed. So anyway, sorry, I interrupted you, Kenny.
I guess all I'm saying is that I think it's just that kind of live experience. That's why I like, you know, I love that recording because it's almost like Edge is exhausted and then you kind of go into the chimes at the end and it's kind of nice melancholy and it's kind of, it's almost recovery time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know, I was probably looking at it from a slightly different perspective, but it's fantastic. Just love it. Great, great track.
Mm. How about you, Sherry? Any thoughts on that?
Well, that was the one track that came from the band's performance in Boston at the Orpheum Theater. So what I was taken by was, you know, that was almost a month prior to Red Rocks, that the quality of the recording of other concerts before they even thought through of bringing in all of the professional grade equipment for Denver surprised me to think that they had been recording at that level earlier into the tour, either for their own personal use or I know that WBCN was a major player certainly in Boston in bringing live music to the greater Boston audience. So that might have also been part of the reason why you had such a professional grade recording of that particular track. But going on the same lines of what you were just saying, Kenny, about Edge's guitar, thinking back to the Hot Press review that Bill Graham gave, where he said that this album's also the Edge Orchestra's main feature so far. His execution has been so effortless and his function so accepted that his massive responsibilities are often overlooked. So I think that it's fantastic that that's what strikes you is indeed Edge's or the beginning of Edge's orchestra.
Yeah, very cool. And it is like sort of a given these days that U2 has, you know, recordings of every single moment of their concerts, you know, Zoo TV onward or whatever. Like it's kind of like assumed, but anything before that, it kind of feels like, but yeah, obviously they were doing some stuff as far as recording almost everything, I think.
Yeah. Who in their right mind had the foresight to be bootlegging a U2 show back in the late 70s? You know? Yeah. The fact that we have some of that stuff still boggles the mind.
Yeah. And someday if and when the vaults ever get unopened or opened, I should say unopened. That's closed, Chris. opened to the public in some way. I can't imagine the flood of material that's out there. Anyways, that's in their vault. So moving on is next one up is a little ditty called I Will Follow. So yeah, we've covered the song itself, obviously, on the Boy episode that we discussed that, and not that we can't repeat some of the ideas there, and we'll sort of overlap a bit with some of that, obviously, throughout this episode. But yeah, interesting. It just jumps out at me as like such a, just like what Kenny was saying, even with Gloria, like just enthusiasm, raw energy, pumped up kind of punkish kind of music. But Sherry, I'll let, before I steal all your thunder on what the song is about on this album, what are your thoughts?
Well, this is, you know, the third or fourth live version of I Will Follow that people have been able to hear up to that point in the career. And what was great about this particular version, and this was from Germany, was, you know, the strength of the song hasn't changed. That enthusiasm hasn't changed. And over almost 40 years, that song still has the same punch as it did back in 80, 81, 82, 83. And to not have that particular song on this type of an album, where the idea was to put into a time capsule the Boy October War era, would have been a huge oversight. So I was happy to have it on. And for me, I'm actually surprised that I Will Follow didn't lead the recording. That if they're not going to go with a war track, why would they go with an October track? I would have assumed that I Will Follow would have been the lead off if they weren't going with a war song. So
yeah, definitely would be the most, would have been right. I don't know if I'm, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it would have been one of the more commonly known tracks by this point for the band of their tour or their concert anyways to select from. Is, I don't know if that's fair, Kenny.
Yeah, no, I think it would have been actually. Yeah.
But maybe they felt like it was already been played enough. Like you said, it, you know, released a couple times or whatever as a live single or live track. And so, but yeah, Kenny, how about you when you hear it or heard it on this album? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's I Will Follow. I mean, it is hard to, I mean, you know, it's I Will Follow. I think that's all I can really say.
See, Kenny, you can get away with that with your accent. It sounds so like... Like, Chris, why? That's such a stupid question. It's I Will Follow. Like, why would you even bother asking? And I'm not even insulted. I'm like, he's right. Like, why would I have even asked?
Well, no, I mean, trying to think about something to say about it is actually really quite hard. Mm-hmm. And I think you actually captured it. And it's the theme of that whole album is the energy and the enthusiasm. I think Sherry's absolutely right. It translates all the way through all their live shows. I think they've always had that kind of punch that goes along with it all. I, again, and maybe this is because I'm a bit of an 80s U2 child and particularly bathed in some of the earlier stuff, I always have at the back of my mind whenever I see them live is this version. And probably I'm almost willing them to replicate it. But yeah. Great track.
Yeah, there's a tendency probably among I Sherry's a little bit earlier than me, but I'm a Aktung Baby sort of Zoo TV fan, and so I'm always kind of like hoping for the Fat Bono voice or whatever to come out, and you know, some of the Zooropa Aktung Baby era kind of U2 stuff is kind of the filter almost that I see them through still, and kind of want them to go back to in a way a certain elements or whatever. So yeah, it's interesting.
And for fans of our particular era where we jumped on the bus, I Will Follow at that point wasn't necessarily a known commodity. You know, it didn't return back into the concert because we didn't have it during the Zoo TV tour or the Zooropa legs. It came back for Pop Mart. And I remember being at Sam Boyd Stadium in Las Vegas. And as soon as I Will Follow hit, it was like, oh my God, I'm finally hearing this live for the first time, even though I had heard it in so many different incarnations through, you know, these types of recordings. But for those who came on the U2 scene in the late 80s, it eluded us for so long.
Yeah. They kind of went through almost a shunning, as it were, from the live set. Like, we're not going to be a greatest hits band. Yeah. Yeah. We're not going to do those anymore or whatever, you know, not forever, obviously, but at least for the time being anyways, and sort of hid them away a bit as they found themselves again. But yeah, I remember that's a good point. I remember at Pop Mart in Edmonton for hearing the I Will Follow live track and yeah, being like, oh, this is that old song. Sorry, Kenny. All right, so we'll keep moving.
Thanks for that.
The end of side one, as it were, back in the day when you had sides to things, was Party Girl.
It's a song called Party Girl. I know a girl called Party Girl. I know she wants more than a party. she won't tell me her name. Oh no, not me.
All right, there we go. Back stuck into the listening to the song and forgetting what the podcast for a moment. This was one of those ones for me listening to it that I could not quite figure out what it was. I remember like not knowing how to reconcile this song with like the I Will Fall, the Pride. You know, again, coming from the forward, working backwards, it just didn't fit with my view of what U2 was, and so often would get skipped if I'm allowed to. Can I say that on a YouTube podcast? I skipped a track occasionally. but reading a bit about it, you know, it's like one of the more frequently played B-sides in U2 history, is according to one site anyways on Wikipedia, and I'm sure
Wikipedia,
I know that's like it's just what comes up first in the Google search results, sure, that's the problem. But yeah, like and definitely this is almost a counterpoint. I remember thinking of Edge's guitar work, because kind of the solo on this one is a little bit goofy. And I could never tell if it was like an intentional mistake or a goofy having fun solo issue.
They've recorded the song in 40 minutes. They were running out of time and needed a B-side for the Celebration single.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it's really one of those throwaway tracks that unless you followed the band very closely and had access to a Celebration single, you would never have heard the song.
Right. Yeah.
its full title is Trash Trampoline and the Party Girl. Party.
Yeah. So what happened to Trash and Trampoline?
I have no idea. But actually, you know what? Chris, you were just saying about the guitar bit in there. Personally, I think, again, I think actually it's really enhanced on this album versus the version that's on a Celebration, because it does sound like it was recorded in 40 minutes. For me, it's a bit of it's a bit trashy, really, actually, to be honest. But good fun. And I think they play it, if I'm right, Sherry, it's almost like a wee bit like when Bono used to take out the champagne if he thought it was a good show. It's kind of almost saved a wee bit for those sort of special moments, or if they think they've had a great show. And rumor has it some of the the lyrics relate to a certain Adam Clayton.
It certainly was a staple in the band's live set from 83 through about 87. Then it took a wee bit of a break. It popped out three times on the Love Town tour. Once on the Zoo TV indoor leg. Let's see here. 1, 2, 3 times on the Zooropa leg. 4 times on Elevation Tour. A little bit more on the Vertigo Tour. And then just a couple times off of 360, and 3 times on the Innocence and Experience. So they certainly save it for a very special occasion nowadays.
Yeah, it's funny. It's just all like, I think, Kenny, you mentioned sort of like a fun celebration kind of, you know, atmosphere or whatever to the song. And that's, I think, again, the filter through which you view you too. I was coming at it from like, this is the serious band who's, you know, doesn't smile in their videos anymore. And they're just like, you know, in the Actong era kind of band, getting rid of the heart on their sleeve and almost, and that kind of era. And this song kind of just did not jive. It felt like a different band almost that was having fun on stage. And not that, yeah, anyways, there's all sorts of interesting angles to approach that. But
I kind of equate Party Girl with Wild Honey.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a similar lightness about it.
Yeah, and even recording quality or whatever, not like Wild Honey's definitely production value is higher probably, but just a similar different instrumentation style and things like that the rest of the band or albums don't have on them. So flipping the record over to side two at this point, while your record starts scratching and bumping at the end of the record.
Or your cassette tape, Be Kind, Please Rewind.
Right. We get Sunday Bloody Sunday.
There's been a lot of talk about this next song. Maybe, maybe too much talk. This song is not a rebel song. This song is Sunday Bloody Sunday.
All right. It goes without saying, obviously, a fairly important song in U2's library, very well known, played obviously quite a bit, and we won't go into all the details of it. Obviously, we talked a bit about it again on a previous episode, but definitely hearing it on this album and sort of in the flow of things was kind of like, this is the classic U2 to me, and a bit of, even though it's a darker subject, definitely the enthusiasm Larry's kicking, like the having the fans sort of shout in recognition to just a simple drum beat kicking off a song, obviously was just kind of exciting. And you knew, even if you didn't know the song, you knew this was an important song in U2's library of music, and as a potential fan or as a fan at the time, was great to hear.
Once again, this was a track that was recorded at that August 20th show in Germany. But for me, because the Red Rocks video was played so often on MTV for Sunday Bloody Sunday, you know, that was, you know, almost the official music video for that particular track. I still equate it to the Denver performance, even though that's not the performance, that's
right.
That's on the actual album.
Yeah, that's totally. I can totally picture that and think of it as being at Red Rocks too. That's interesting. Kenny, how about you? When you like, obviously knowing, being very familiar with the song, obviously, and hearing it on this as part of the live collection, what were your thoughts?
Interestingly enough, actually, I'm the same as Sherry. This song makes me think of the video, very much so. Simply because, well, on this album, this song for me is all about Bono's T-shirt. I think it was
the shirt
coolest
we all wanted, right?
Absolutely, I think it was the coolest tour T-shirt they've probably done. Well, that's maybe not fair, but certainly, I mean, it's pretty iconic in my mind. Apart from the fact Bono cut off his sleeves and all that jazz, but just that whole kind of the whole war stage up. They had the flags, they had the album cover behind Larry, and that's where that song always takes me to. So I think I'm exactly the same as Sherry, albeit the fact it was recorded elsewhere. That for me is the song that directs you towards the video or the DVD, as you would call it, and it's definitely all about T-shirts.
That's awesome. I had never thought of that connection point, but I can totally see how a young Kenny would
with my mullet.
Yeah,
my mullet haircut.
Between that and the black and red stripe, or rather plaid shirt that Edge was wearing.
That's right.
Now you can't separate the visual from the audio on that particular track in this era.
Yeah. I'm looking at an image of just on Google image search of U2 Live Red Rocks, and it's from behind, like I'm guessing on stage or whatever, of Edge and Bono out a bit on the extension of the stage or whatever. I was going to say B stage, but not quite then. But and they
lowercase B stage.
Yeah, they both look like nothing like what a rock star would look like even today. I guess maybe a bit of the shoegazer band going on, but more like dad rock kind of thing almost, if anything. The plaid that Edge is wearing, properly tucked in, Doesn't quite scream rock and roll these days, but definitely
is. The electrical tape belt that Bono had does scream out rock and roll, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. That's some fun looks through U2's history, that's for sure. No getting away from that one. All right, moving on. Electrico. All right, you both wanted this one, so I'm going to throw it to Sherry first this time.
This track, the live version far surpasses the recorded version. And for me, I connected with the Rage in a way that I had never connected with U2 before. And for me, that particular song is the standout of the entire album. And the fact that it's buried on side B, you know, I guess if you only have a 34-minute album, you're going to need to make a few, you know, decisions about the track listing. But for this particular track as well, it's the track that got the band into the most amount of trouble. To the point where they had to reissue the recordings, because the original recording still had the snippet of Stephen Sondheim's Send in the Clowns, even though he had changed the word from clown to crowd, where they had to pay upwards of a $50,000 penalty for not having licensing and royalty permission to put it onto their album. So if you happen to have a Under Blood Red Sky vinyl that has the full version of this album, you've got something that's worth a lot of money, because that's a very rare collectible.
That's so good, because I do.
There you go.
Insure it, Kenny. Insure it.
All right, I definitely will do. Because it's really weird listening to the reissued version, because I always wait for them to kick into that bit, but it just kind of ticks along, obviously. But yeah, I've got that. That shows my age now.
It might not be worth $50,000 yet, I guess, to back to U2 for covering the licensing fees, but.
There's very few of them in existence. probably a few more than the original U2-3 vinyl, but it is among one of the top U2 rarities for sure.
There you go. How about for you, Kenny, hearing this song?
I think Sherry kind of summed it up pretty well. I mean, it's kind of like, I think how they've actually chosen a lot of the songs actually for the album. Apart from maybe Trash Trampoline, where they kind of let you draw breath a wee bit, it's driving, it's fast. I agree. I think it's, you know, it's better than the recorded version. I love it just the way I love the rest of the album. Just because I actually quite like Bono's vocals on this whole piece. I think you were talking earlier on about Chris, you know, when he gets a wee bit older and the voice changes. And I quite like some of the sort of shouty, screamy stuff that he did in those days. And I think that actually probably added to the effect of the performance. But it's a great song. And obviously you get the bonus of having the cry piece at the beginning as well, and having it captured alongside the overall live song. So great track.
Yeah, and it's... is this not the one? I'm rusty on my U2 history here, so forgive me if I'm. But like where Bono would sort of roam the stage a bit more, climbing things and
yes,
stuff as well.
This is the one where everybody yelled at him
to not do it anymore for safety reasons, right? Okay, right. And what does I'm trying to remember what if we covered this? Like for me, the I'm sorry if you're tired of me going back to this trope, I guess, of how I viewed it. But often, even just the name of the song was a weird, like, I was like, why is it called the Electrico? That's like the thing in Monopoly that you don't want, or it's annoying property to get on Monopoly or something. Like, what's the significance of the name or whatever? And it was kind of silly, you know, in hindsight, obviously, just kind of like getting a little mental hook in my brain about just the title of the song instead of just enjoying the song, obviously. And now, like, when I do listen to it and am listening to it, it's like, totally feel the energy and excitement and just that riff of just a high energy riff of opening the song with that. Definitely gets me over any issue of Monopoly money, as it were. So, but yeah. All right, moving on to next track is another small little song, U2 history, that you might not have heard of, called New Year's Day. All right, as much as I want to keep listening, again, we covered a bit of the discussion of the song on the War episode, but including it here feels like an obvious choice anyways, like a very popular song. And if you weren't familiar with it for whatever reason, having the live version just increases the enjoyment of the song, I think, like is often something we've said about U2 songs, how the live versions often just help you love the album track even that much more. And no question, like, one of Adam Clayton's top five, if not the top kind of baseline contributions to U2's archives, albums and music and stuff. But I don't know, what do you guys think of the song as both included on the album and sort of how it sounded into your ears?
I think I mentioned that at the beginning, this song, I think, established, certainly any concerts I ever go to, whenever they play this, I can always hear the crowd around me at the beginning when Bono does his wail. At the beginning, everybody kind of goes there. And I actually remember going to see them in Glasgow Barrowlands and the Unforgettable Fire Tour. And Bono didn't even manage to open his mouth. And, you know, the crowd just sung that back to him, because it was just not that, really that long off the back of Under a Blood Red Sky. And I think that just helps cement that. I mean, it was a great track anyway. But again, just how they transform the studio song to the live version. And it was just another great example of how they do it so well. And then Bono putting his extra bit of heart and soul into it just to kind of kick it off. And you know, even in later tours when I've seen him, you can almost see the crowd a wee bit disappointed, because he kind of toned it down a bit on later outings. I mean, immense. And as you say, Adam's bass at the beginning is fantastic. So great song, magic.
Yeah, and as I think I said on the War episode, is as much as it's like a song you know and you've heard so much and you kind of think of as being maybe tired of, and, you know, okay, I'm bored of hearing it or something like that. Even once you start listening to it, it's impossible, at least for me anyway, it's impossible to just stop, because it's like still such a, it draws you in, it pulls you into the performance and the song in a way that a lot of other songs that I've listened to way too much and, you know, get tired of or whatever, don't have that staying power and that ability to sort of pull you back in, and just the energy that they've performed it with. Because I know I remember my friend who introduced me to U2 was like a huge New Year's Day fan and probably played it 16,000 times in my high school career or whatever. And so it's definitely been locked in my brain for a long time. But how about you, Sherry? Any sort of recollections of it as you heard?
Yeah, it's a song that the European audience embraced immediately, and it's one that the American audience slow to embrace, but once we've embraced it, it's got that evergreenness where, you know, when it's performed live along with Sunday Bloody Sunday, the entire audience roars with it. But back in 83, it didn't have that same kind of resonance. So it's no surprise that the version that made it onto the album was the one from Germany.
Yeah, it's interesting, sort of, you know, if they had, for whatever reason, had just included straight from Red Rocks, what the crowd sounds might have been or whatever, how that could have even changed things, you know, for the song, like you said, with in North America versus Europe and stuff like that. And no doubt still a good song, like it's not going to change, but the enthusiasm that you hear back from the crowd kind of tells you that you should be enthusiastic about the song, even if you weren't before you started listening. So, all right, well, it's time to end the podcast, so we must end with 40. So here we go.
Sing this with me. This is 40.
All right, just put your hand in the air if you got chills still listening to that, even though you've heard it many, many times like I did. That's okay. It's okay to admit that.
Hands in the air.
Even on the compressed MP3 version that you're listening to somewhere out in the world as you listen to this podcast later. But actually, tweet me some sort of like hands in the air thing. iChris on Twitter. I'm curious if you're willing to respond that way. Or chills, maybe hashtag chills just for fun. I know there's lots of U2 songs that probably do that for U2 fans, but that's one for me anyway. Sherry, why don't you lead us off on 40?
Yeah, this is the one track that has a lot of history at Red Rocks, with the whole story about how tour manager Dennis Sheehan had gotten the crowd singing the refrain, "How long to sing this song," towards the end of it to get that audience participation in it. But by the time of the tour moving over to Europe, it certainly sounded like they didn't need Dennis's encouragement to sing it back. So when you've got the audio of the of the song released almost 9 months before the video comes out, you're already programmed to think, you know, to sing along at the end, that it's something that all the audiences must have done with this particular track. But to have the starting point of that sing back happen at Red Rocks, it puts it all into a different perspective. And being a fan who started going to concerts back in 92, where 40 wasn't necessarily part of the set list, you know, we were already programmed. You sing "How Long" at the end of that song, because up to that point, you know, throughout the Joshua Tree tour, as the bootlegs started circulating amongst fans, you know, you would hear 40 and everybody singing along to it. So I kind of feel like people were already programmed because of this particular live album to sing along. But that sort of revisionist history, because that wasn't really the case at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that those somewhat self-created mythologies, but also, yeah, fan influenced, obviously. It's kind of a play back and forth with between the band and the audience as to what is going to catch on, obviously, and then what they themselves as the band decides to sort of amplify back out to the wider community as a thing we do, almost a call and response type thing. And so how about you, Kenny, hearing this song both like way back then and now?
I know. Well, yeah, probably way back then you probably didn't quite realize what it was going to come to be, actually. So, you know, it was a song that certainly all the shows I went to, there was a lot of response back from the crowd. Mind you, Glasgow crowds tend to be kind of any opportunity for a sing along, they kind of, you know, they'll go for it. But I always remember I mean, it was very different for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's obviously well documented about Edge and Adam swapping, but on the kind of that whole kind of concept of the tour, it just fitted so well in terms of that kind of, you know, I was talking about earlier on, it's like, you know, you're kind of running at 100 miles an hour and then there's a kind of gradual sort of, as you sort of almost ease yourself out of the process. I think it's a fantastic strong song. You know, there's no accident it was the last song, albeit the fact in those days it was on side two. And I, for one, whenever they do play their last show, hope that that's the song that they close with, because I think it just sums up them quite nicely.
Yeah, definitely. That's well, no more discussion of U2's last song.
For it's now. True. Yeah.
We've got enough chills and good spirits going on. We don't need to. I'm just kidding. That probably should be a podcast game at this point too. Is anytime somebody. Matt especially, I think, is guilty of it, bringing up when U2 is going to play their last song.
No.
But yeah, it's a great song to end the concert video or concert sort of documentation of the concert, I guess I was going to say, experience. And I'm glad and happy with the way it has become a thing that they do over the years too, just as a, like you said, whether you're into, like we talked about in previous episodes, whether you're attracted to the spiritual side of what U2 gets into, and obviously this is a fairly heavy one that way, if you want it to be, it can also just be a great way to sort of like the cigarette after the end of the concert, as it were. Terrible analogy. But
I'm glad you said that.
Somebody like me has to put their foot in their mouth at some point. Yeah, as a way to send out the concerts, send off the concert when it's finished. So, but yeah.
It's also the bookend with it starting with Gloria, you know, and ending with 40. And the U2 mass was in between.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, on that note, we need to end our podcast. I was going to say our concert. We're not quite there yet. We will be sure to tune in next time. We're going to be discussing the Unforgettable Fire. Obviously, is the next album in the discography. I always mispronounce that word. If you're listening live and want to listen to this episode later, you can find it at goodstuff.fm/ATU2/38. Or if you want to find out links to things we discussed and stuff like that along the way, you can, like I said, goodstuff.fm/ATU2/38. That's probably the number one question I get from folks is where to find, you always talk about the show notes and links and stuff. Where do I find them? So that's where you can go to find those. You can follow the At U2 crew on Twitter at ATU2 and facebook.com/ATU2com. And while Sherry answers her phone, Kenny, where can folks find you on Twitter?
I love it. I'm at Sing No More, which is all one word. And you can also find me on the forum if you come and visit there. And likewise, I'm going to Dublin along with some of, well, actually, I think the entire Europe at U2 staff. So Aaron, Carol, and Donald, and myself, I don't think. Oh, and Lisith as well, sorry. I think we're all going there as well. So if anybody's along there, I'll catch you along there.
Awesome. Yeah, I look forward to that. And Sherry, how about you? Where can folks find you on Twitter if they...
Well, you can reach me at my home number, which really? I keep forwarding to my cell phone. And for whatever reason, it's not forwarding. So I wish it was an unknown caller, but that's a whole nother album discussion down the line. Thank you. I worked hard on that one. you can reach me at U2ComSherry on Twitter. Sorry about the phone, guys.
That's okay. That's the fun of a live podcast, too. That's no big deal. And I'm iChris on Twitter. I don't have a phone ringing in the background, so there's no cues for me. I don't have entrance music like Sherry has, as it were. Is there anything else I'm supposed to mention? I think that's it for this episode. Of course, visit atu2.com for news about Cleveland. I'm sure between now and the next recording, we'll have more to tell you about. So don't wait for the podcast episode. Hopefully this isn't the only place you're getting your U2 news from, but if it is, we'll have more for you next time. But be sure to check out atu2.com. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. And Sherry, we'll have a...
I'm throwing my phone up at this point.
New phone next time we record.
Sorry, guys.
Thanks for listening. Bye, guys.